You're listening to KZFR 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Chico, California.
It's the Peace and Social Justice Show on KZFR. It's the Peace and Social Justice Show on KZFR. Don't touch that dial and stay right where you are. It's the Peace and Social Justice Show on KZFR.
Welcome to the Peace and Social Justice program for Friday, February 20th, 2026. I'm your host today, Robert Jones. We're going to be talking today about the state of the nation, the abysmal state of the Trump administration, and in particular, questions about, are there cracks in this authoritarian administration? I'm really pleased to welcome two guests who have been on the program before. Professor John Sanban Matsu is joining us today. He's joining us from Massachusetts. He's professor of philosophy in the Department of Humanities and Arts at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts, where he teaches classes in ethics, philosophy of technology, existentialism, and phenomenology, among others. Professor Sanban Matsu's work in critical animal studies probes the nature of speciesism as a mode of production, particularly as it intersects with capitalism. He is the author of a few books, The Postmodern Prince, Critical Theory, Left Strategy, and the Making of a New Political Subject, A Critique of Post-Structuralism and an Attempt to Reconstitute Left Social Theory. And he edited the book, Critical Theory and Animal Liberation. His new book out is The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and Ourselves, which is out on NYU Press. John Sanban Matsu, thank you for coming. Welcome to the Peace and Justice Show.
Thanks for having me again.
We're also joined by, here in California, Sasha Abramski, born and raised in the UK, where he studied politics, philosophy, and economics at Balliol College, Oxford. He has lived and worked in London, New York, and currently resides right here down the road in Sacramento, California. His writings have appeared in The Nation, The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Guardian, The Village Voice, Rolling Stone, The Atlantic, and many numerous other publications. He is the author of a number of books, including Inside Obama's Brain, The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives, The House of 20,000 Books, Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream, and Chaos Comes Calling, The Battle Against the Far-Right Takeover of Small Town America. Sasha's most recent book is American Carnage, How Trump, Musk, and Doge Butchered the U.S. Government, now out on OR Books. Sasha Abramski is also a lecturer at UC Davis in the University Writing Program, and his latest piece at The Nation, which is a part of his new regular column there called Authoritarian Watch, is The Republican Crackup Has Begun. Sasha, welcome back to the Peace and Social Justice Program.
Always fun to be on, Robert. Thanks for having me.
Sasha, let's start with you. You have an article out, which I'll put a link to in the show notes. The Republican crackup has begun. Sasha, has it really begun? What are you seeing that is indicating that the Republican crackup has begun? And how much of a crackup is it?
Well, full disclaimer, I have nothing to do with the headlines for my own column. So that headline was chosen by somebody else. But I do think it speaks to something that we're starting to see, which is that gradually Republicans are willing to peel off from the MAGA movement and from Trump in particular. And we're seeing it around the Epstein files. We're seeing it around ICE and whether or not what ICE did and is still doing in Minnesota is even remotely appropriate. We're seeing it around some of Trump's claims about how he's going to take control of the elections. We're seeing it in some of his sort of more outrageous social media posts, including the one last week where he portrayed the Obamas as monkeys. And, you know, that was so outrageous, it began to get at least some limited Republican pushback. I think what we're seeing is not the wholesale disintegration of the MAGA movement. That's still there. It's still dangerous. It still needs to be countered in every way we can. But I do think what we're seeing is the beginning of a process where Republicans realize that they can actually stake a position that isn't exactly where Donald Trump is. Now, that's sort of not exactly the most revolutionary stance to take, but it's a beginning, because for the first year of this administration, or nearly a year, virtually no Republican would cross Trump. They were terrified of him. They were terrified of MAGA. They were terrified of what would happen to them electorally. They were terrified of being threatened physically. But now you're starting to see some pushback against Trump's outrages. I don't think it's green shoots necessarily, but you know, it's the very, very beginnings of the Republican Party trying to work out what a post-Trump era is going to look like.
Now, also, you mentioned that there's some peeling off, you know, within the MAGA movement. And last week we saw the Attorney General Pam Bondi. I don't even know how to characterize that performance. That was a performance for one, obviously, where she was many non sequiturs, and she came off really poorly. And my understanding is, at least, I mean, I haven't seen polls, but my understanding is that performance by Pam Bondi, I mean, other than Donald Trump, who posted a Truth Social supporting her, the word on the street is that that performance did not help support MAGA support. I don't know if you've, have either of you heard anything about that performance affecting MAGA allegiance?
I haven't seen polling on it. I mean, I did see some of the testimony. It was catastrophic. It was the most embarrassing, debased congressional testimony I think I've ever seen from a senior member of the cabinet. It was designed, as you said, solely to fluff the ego of Donald J. Trump. It had nothing to do with the traditional role of an attorney general. It had none of the dignity that the office usually is associated with. She got in one screaming match after another with Democrats and Republicans alike. And by the end of it, she looked like a petulant teenager. I mean, all of her dignity, all of her authority, you could see it evaporating the longer that that congressional testimony went on. And I can't imagine, outside of the most fanatical MAGA base, I can't imagine anybody looked at that and said that was a stellar performance by somebody who, you know, really has the chops to be an attorney general, because it wasn't.
John San Bonmatsu, you're perched there in Boston, the Boston area. Can give us a little, can you do a, I don't know, just a general, what are your general impressions of the regime or the state of the nation? Give us a, give me some of your, because we've had conversations, you and I, and you've had some keen insights into the current state of the polity. So what do you got for us?
First of all, I want to say it's a pleasure again to be alongside Sasha here. And I urge listeners to check out his column in The Nation. Maybe he'll talk about that experience. Robert Kagan, the neocon who's the co-founder of the Project for New American Century, was on the Christiane Amanpour show this last week. And he was warning, as he has been warning for some years, that we are plunging into a dictatorship. And Amanpour kind of pointed out some of these hopeful signs, you know, that Trump was not able to, the Justice Department was not able to get the grand jury indictment of the Congress people who had addressed America's armed forces, urging them to disobey, you know, illegal orders. He talked about Holman, Tom Holman, the border czar in Minneapolis, pulling back troops. You talked about, you know, some defection among GOP people around the tariffs. As, you know, she was kind of implying, well, you know, has, are we seeing a turning of the tide? And Kagan just laughed, shook his head and said, I don't agree with that. It's one step forward, two steps back with Trump. And I really want to caution against any hope whatsoever that we're seeing anything that could possibly stop a fascist takeover of this country. There's so little institutional resistance. The left is completely disorganized, has no strategy. And I want to go further and say that one of the problems that we've seen, you know, consistently for years on the left is a kind of reactive politics in defense of an indefensible social and political and economic order. I mean, the very best that we seem to be hoping for is not to have a king these days, right? But the problems that, the forces that led to the election of Trump and now the consolidation of what can only be described as a fascist polity are deeply rooted in the contradictions of the capitalist world system. And this is an international phenomenon. It isn't just, right, not just Trump. So until and unless we have a movement that's capable of, mature enough to kind of identify the nature of this crisis and to begin proposing civilizational reforms that can get at the root of this crisis, then to me, it's spitting in the wind. Even if we were able to redeem, you know, to go back to the status quo ante, which was a corrupt liberal democratic order, which has now been revealed. I'm glad you brought the Epstein files, revealed in the Epstein scandal, just how deep the rot goes. It's a losing game. I'm anti-fascist. I'm all for stopping Trump and MAGA. I think that's our, in a way, our second most important quest today. The first most important and connected to it is to slow the ecological collapse of our planet, which, by the way, Trump didn't create. So that's my jaundiced view, is that the forces that we're developing, and by the way, Kagan, sorry to ramble here, but Kagan, in his interview with Amanpour, said that the only thing that's standing between us and a dictatorship are popular citizen movements, as we saw in Minneapolis. I think we can all agree that that's the most hopeful thing going on. But it would have to be really, much better organized and really dug in for the long term to be able to ensure we're not back right where we are, in 4, 5, 10 years, even if we could block Trump's takeover.
John Sanbonmatsu, you brought up a lot of great points. And I want to reiterate something you said. You don't want to encourage people to have hope, but there might be some hope. Let me on the issue of, inert force fighting fascism, let's talk about for a moment the Democrats. The Democrats, you have Hakeem Jeffries, House Minority Leader. You have Senate Minority Leader. Chuck Schumer seem pretty ineffectual when it comes to standing up to fascism. I don't know if we could call them the controlled opposition or authoritarian collaborators or fascist collaborators. But so it looks like looking to the Democrats, I see AOC on social media every once in a while giving some pushback, but what do you say to folks who say, well, what we need to do is rally the progressive faction of the Democratic Party to give pushback?
Well, we all know that policy, that strategy has failed. There are little moments of hope here and there, little hiccups, I suppose, in the system, such as Mamdani's unexpected sweep in overwhelming victory in New York, by the way, against an open conspiracy by the Democratic Party to destroy his his mayoral run, in an open league with the largest landlords and capitalist investors of New York City, and Albany and so forth. And just as we saw the Democratic Party conspire to destroy Bernie Sanders' candidacy in 2015, which they succeeded in doing. It's just clear that, again, we could talk about the Epstein files, and I want to hear what Sasha has to say, but this system is broken forever. It is completely corrupt, and that's why the populace is sympathetic to fascism, is because people at some intuitive level, visceral level, understand that this system is completely kaput. Now, so that's why I say rallying around these failed institutions and parties is simply completely losing proposition in my view.
Sasha Abramski, are you as hopeless for the Democrats as John is? What do you see? Any pushback, any hope in the Democrats to save the polity?
I sort of agree and disagree with what John was saying. I agree with what you're saying, John, that overwhelmingly the pressure for change is going to come from the grassroots, not from institutional systems like the Democratic Party. I do agree with that. And I think we're seeing that starting to form. It's incomplete. It's obviously, as you said, there's a risk of one step forward, two steps backwards. But we are seeing an extraordinary grassroots effort against the might of the state. And we saw it in Minneapolis in the most honorable way possible, where thousands and thousands of people basically went out in the streets non-violently, knowing their lives were at risk, to take on these armed thugs that ICE had unleashed on the city. Where I'm a little bit sort of differ from you, I do think that there is room for a progressive democratic coalition to emerge electorally. And I don't think that you can sort of scrub the entire Democratic Party and say, all right, don't like them on this, don't like them on that, and therefore they're a failed institution. I think over history, really interesting political leaders have come out of the Democratic Party, whether you're talking about Franklin Roosevelt or whether you're talking about Obama, however flawed Obama was, or whether you're talking about, you know, Kennedy and Johnson, both of whom were deeply flawed figures in the 60s, but both of whom did take America, domestically at least, on a more progressive arc. So I don't think I would give up on the Democratic Party in quite the way that you are. But I do agree with you that much of what Trump has taken over, it's pointless to say, well, we just need to go back. That you can't roll back the clock to a system that showed itself to be that brittle and that much of a sort of failure of imagination. And so I think whatever comes next, and I do think there will be, you know, a post-Trump chapter, it may take a while, but this country isn't going to be mired in Trump's nonsense forever. Whatever comes next is going to look different from what came before Trump. And whatever is rebuilt is going to have to be rebuilt in a different way to what came before Trump, not just domestically, but internationally. You know, America was seen as the sort of indispensable keystone for 80 years after World War II. Nobody's going to consider America that anymore because we've shown ourselves so untrustworthy and so fickle. And, you know, frankly, any country that can elect Donald Trump not once but twice, the second time after he had shown all of his criminal tendencies, that country has forfeit an awful lot of trust on the global stage. And I think that when you look at America's web of alliances, whether it's with Europe or whether it's with countries in Asia or whether it's the soft power alliances that America had in Africa that were generated in part, at least, by USAID's activities, that now those alliances have been fractured. And now America will be seen at best as a sort of necessary but fickle partner. And I think that will change America's role on the global stage over the next, you know, next chapters of American history and global history. And I don't know exactly what that will look like, but I do know it won't look like the indispensable nation that we were portrayed as being for the better part of three quarters of a century.
That's the voice of Sasha Abramski, and you're joined. He's joining me today on the Peace and Social Justice Program, along with Professor John Sanban Matsu. We're discussing the state of the nation and this, the effects of the nation internationally. I want to come back to the question, if we can. I have a couple of questions. I want to tie the Mamdani victory, and I also want to connect that with some of this Epstein stuff. But before we do that, Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, where a commitment to pure ingredients and sustainable brewing meets a legacy of craft since 1980. Sierra Nevada, taste what matters. Please drink responsibly. And by Dana Campbell Law, providing compassionate, comprehensive trust and estate planning and administration. Dana, her daughter Tara, and their staff also offer healthcare directives, conservatorships, and special needs trusts with decades of experience to help protect your family's assets and peace of mind. Prepare for tomorrow and your family's future by visiting danacampbelllaw.com. And if you enjoy this program, you can now go to kzfr.org and tip this show. Well, John Sanban Matsu, I want to hear some of your responses to what Sasha had to say. He's a little more optimistic about the party politics, particularly Democrats, than you are. And I want to circle back this this Mamdani victory. What can we glean, if anything, about the Mamdani victory? Some of the things that came to mind for me were, it seems like he ran against the billionaire class, you know, the Davos class, the Epstein class, as they're calling it now. He ran a pretty savvy campaign. Free buses, childcare. And yet I recently saw a poll that said, you know, 6 out of 10 Americans believe that they have a shot of being billionaires. So it's interesting. There's an interesting kind of zeitgeist in America where there's a certain kind of anti-elite pushback. And yet the masses have this kind of magical thinking. They think, well, I'm going to be a billionaire someday, so I don't want to be too tough on the billionaires. Anyway, so there's a lot going on, I think, with that Mamdani victory in New York. And I don't know, what are your thoughts, first of all, in response to what Sasha said, and secondly, about this, what can we glean from Mamdani, if anything, positive?
Well, yeah, I appreciate what you were saying, Sasha. I think we do disagree fundamentally about the nature of this crisis. I don't think it can be reduced, not that you were necessarily doing this, but a lot of people do, to a kind of political conjuncture. You know, Trump and MAGA are a kind of a flash in the pan, or we can hope, or that they are some kind of anomaly. There are continuities and discontinuities, right, between this fascist formation and what's gone before, right? You mentioned Obama. Obama's number one contributor to the first presidential campaign was Goldman Sachs. Well, that says it all. I mean, that the Democratic Party is bought and sold and owned by the capitalist class. It is simply fact. And now, you know, I don't disagree that we can find and do find, you know, little insurgent efforts within the party to push up against that corporate machinery. But we all know that the Justice Democrats have had a very hard time. We know that pro-Israeli lobby groups have destroyed progressives in races and so forth. So it's a completely corrupt party. It has been. And more than that, it's the symptom and cause of an imperial world order. I totally agree with you, Sasha, that we're seeing the end of the American, the new American century predicted by Henry Luce. Like it's suddenly come to an end because the U.S. can't rule through naked force alone. I don't know. Some people think so. I don't think so. This is the end. But I think that when the U.S. comes down the way it's coming down, it's not just the American brand, but everything that comes with it that has now come into question. The delegitimation of a certain universal norm. You know, even if the discourse of human rights and international law were a fraud at some level, there was something important about that. And that's now over, right? I mean, so we're heading to very quickly to a multipolar world in which the U.S. remains, primus inter pares. It remains the first and most powerful and dangerous country. But at the same time, you know, China, Russia, other authoritarian regimes are gaining market share, and they're going to continue to, because again, the anarchic, violent forces that are embedded in the capitalist system create these social fissures, and those are not going away. And so again, we need some kind of plausible account of how this crisis can be addressed at a fundamental level, which is the level of class, right? Because we have a monopolization of the means of money and therefore the means of power. Now, getting back to Mamdani and so forth, I agree completely that what we saw in Minneapolis, and Sasha, you were very eloquent in describing the significance of what happened, and I don't mean to diminish that. And also Mamdani, but look at Mamdani. He's not challenging the fundamental property relations of the society, right? Let alone the international division of labor, blah blah blah, or the commodity system. So these are just surface level things. They're important. We need to fight for them. It is not helping the overall picture ultimately, which is a sinking ship. And we can have this conversation in 5 years if we're still around and not in a deportation camp or concentration camp. But all of the crises, social, ecological, political, economic crises that we see, technological with AI, are going to worsen. They're going to deepen, in my view. Anyway, that's my pessimistic view.
Sasha, where do you come down on this? Any hope in?
Look, John, you're completely right that to regard Trump and MAGA as an anomaly misses the deeper historical moment. So Trump comes out of 50 years at least of declining working class wages. He comes out of the, complete despair of the financial crisis of 2008. He comes out of the disillusionment of the forever wars. He comes out of decades of mass incarceration, mass addiction, mass homelessness. There are many, many social fissures that sort of Trump manages to harness, anxieties he manages to harness, and he does it in a uniquely skillful demagogic way because he's a very skillful demagogue. I don't think those fundamental crises disappear when Trump disappears. I do agree with you. They're deeper. They're hardwired into the American experience at this point. They're hardwired into the global experience at this point. But I do think Trump's a unique figure. He had a unique ability to harness a coalition of angry, discontented people. And he has a unique ability to present himself, however irrationally, as a savior figure. And that is, you know, classic cult charismatic leadership. Where I have, you know, a little bit more optimism than you, I think, is even though Trump and MAGA aren't anomalies, it takes a unique political persona like Trump to fuse it all together. And I do think when Trump goes, and, you know, he's a mortal man, like every other human being on earth, his time will come. And when the Trump era is over, I do think that it provides room for a reimagining of what America is, or maybe more importantly, what it can be. Because I think that, you know, I think we're all in agreement here, whatever the next chapter of America is going to be, it can't simply be a reversion to a past that created all the conditions for Trump to arise in the first place. But I think that that door doesn't fully open until we get into the post-MAGA period. That, you know, we've got this, you know, several years now where we've got an increasingly malignant, maybe senile political leadership that is good at one thing. And the one thing it's good at is consolidating and holding on to power, and to do it really, really ruthlessly. And I think that as long as that equation still holds, we're going to be talking about change at the margins, and it's going to be a defensive posture. We're going to get victories like Mamdani's election in New York. We're going to get victories like the pushback against ICE in Minnesota. But fundamentally, as long as the MAGA movement's in power, progressives are going to be on the defensive. And I think, you know, our challenge is to stay coherent enough and think long-term enough to get beyond that defensive moment and to get to a place where it's time and, you know, possible to reimagine the future in a, you know, more kind, compassionate, inclusive way.
John Sanmonmatsu, I want you to respond to Sasha, but I also want to tie in, I'm going to explicitly bring up the release, or what we have released, of the Epstein files and what we've discovered. I think there's a lot in there. Obviously, people are still going through them, but there's the aspect of the sort of total moral debauchery of the Trump and that class. But I think importantly, in connecting this to the questions of the billionaire class, we see that what's revealed in the Epstein files, and we all knew it was there. I mean, and you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I think it's interesting that QAnon people are remaining quiet all of a sudden. Their whole thing was about some kind of pedophile cabal at a pizza joint in DC. But what peel back the surface, and what we see is they're actually, what we've known is confirmed, is that there is a Davos class, a ruling class, that have utter contempt for basic morals and ethics, things that people take for granted that people should have, and they don't. We see that they are there. I mean, I can't resist but bring up how disappointed I am in Noam Chomsky. I mean, so, you know, what does the Davos class, the ruling class, the billionaire class, what is that? What do they have in common with Noam Chomsky? And that was disappointing to me. So I was wondering if you can give some reflections of the connections between what you're talking about, this sort of global capitalist system, and the sort of, maybe it's the patriarchy that they have in common. What are you learning about that system from the revelations in the Epstein files, John?
Yeah, let me first agree with you, Sasha, about Trump as a fusion figure. I mean, something really important. I agree that if Trump were to die tomorrow, it's not at all clear, you know, how the movement is would be able to cohere, particularly around a single person. So I totally agree with that. You know, Hitler and Mussolini and so forth, they were the fruition of years and decades, centuries of development. But there was something unique about them. This is what Hegel talks about world historical individuals, kind of as the lightning rods of spirit and so on. That said, I'm skeptical that there would be a post-MAGA period if Trump were to die tomorrow, because I think we're seeing what I've described as a fascist social formation. So these are things rooted in society, in paramilitarism and uneven development, you know, between urban and rural areas, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we agree about a lot of this. Regarding the Epstein files, I mean, it's interesting to read an establishment paper like the New York Times and have journalists referring to the ruling class casually. You know, it's like, oh yeah, there is a ruling class. We all know it. They're finally naming it, and we know it's corrupt. And it cuts against across ideological and party differences, right? And I think this is really crucial. I know I'm sounding like a raging Marxist in this broadcast, but honestly, maybe because I'm teaching my course on capitalism at the moment. But honestly, Marx and Engels and others in the 19th century pointed out that the nature of competition in a free, quote, free market society is its opposite, which is monopolization, right? Free competition leads to companies taking over smaller companies and so on. And we see this across, you know, every single industry in the last 30 years, especially increased monopolization. What does that mean? It means increased concentration of wealth in the hands of a few. It means, therefore, because economic power is translates instantly into social power and political power, we have this unaccountable class that's depraved. They have no moral scruples whatsoever. The CEO at Barclays Bank was apparently biting his victims. You know, so it's very much about patriarchy, absolutely misogyny. That is the nature of the reality that we live in, and it's been laid bare. But you know, what do we do about this? It's not enough. You know, people losing their jobs and so on. It doesn't touch the problem, right? Which again are these fundamental laws and structures of capitalist development that you know, are not touched by such scandals. So now there is the potential for, you know, harnessing, you know, is what you were talking about, Sasha, harnessing the way Trump harnesses these social contradictions, these forces, these fissures. There's a way that the left could do that. I mean, I think that's why I always return to Antonio Gramsci's work, because Gramsci was talking about how to do just this, how to exert what he called moral and intellectual leadership to build a new basis in civil society for a new civilization. And I want to put it that way. I don't think the question is what's going to happen to America after Trump. You know, to be honest, I don't care what happens to America after Trump. What I'm interested in is a whole world order in which billions of people, trillions of non-human animals are being crushed under the wheels of a system that is inimical to life on the planet Earth, you know. And so somehow we have to muster the resources to, as a movement, to challenge the fundamental basis of power that led to the Epstein files, right? We have to, and it is a moment. I mean, it's a moment where we could take advantage of this to begin educating people about the true nature of power, right? This is what Machiavelli did in The Prince. This is what Gramsci did in his remarks on The Modern Prince, to educate the people about the nature of power and why the system is corrupt and needs to be overthrown. And that's the word I would use. It has to be overthrown. It isn't about reforming the system, you know, putting new laws in place to tax the rich, or, I mean, it's just absurd. Capitalist regulation has never worked. Regulation of capital has never worked.
So, John, you're not a fan of I hear the mantra that we need to return to a kind of FDR solution to these problems. You don't think that this, that kind of...
Well, FDR, through my father's family in concentration camps in Arizona, you know, the executive order for the internment of Japanese Americans. So I don't have that pleasant a memory of FDR, but no, I don't think that liberal social democracy can work, and Trump is the proof of that.
Sasha, what's your take on what can we learn from the revelations in the Epstein files about power and the things that John is talking about?
Well, I think one thing we learn is there clearly is a group of people at the top of society, economically and politically, who play by different rules. I mean, but I don't think we needed the Epstein files to know that. I mean, you know, you could look at the financial crisis of 2008 and you come to the same conclusion. This is particularly sordid. It's particularly salacious. It's, you know, it has all the ingredients of scandal because it's a sex scandal rather than a financial scandal. But, you know, the hints have been there for many, many years that our system of democracy is somewhat you know, very skewed in favor of the rich and the powerful. There's no mystery there. There's no mystery to the fact that America in recent years has slid ever more towards an oligarchical economic structure. And, you know, fundamentally what you're seeing with Epstein is a confluence of oligarchs, people who, you know, some Democrats, some Republicans, some, you know, non-party affiliation. But the common theme is they have an awful lot of money, an awful lot of power, and they're willing to use and abuse that money and that power. For me, when you were talking earlier about, you know, why is it that England, there's been a little bit more accountability regarding the Epstein files, and in America, none. You know, historically in England, there's been a very strong sense of collective responsibility at the cabinet level, which means basically you fess up to mistakes that you've made and you offer to resign, and that resignation offer is accepted. And there's a whole standard process around that. And for better or worse, it's one of the things that, you know, for many, many hundreds of years, anchored the UK's political system. And if you read the sort of unwritten constitutions that were described by Walter Bagehot and some of the other Victorian theorists, they were very adamant that you had to have this notion of collective responsibility at the government level. And that used to be the case to a degree in America as well. If there was a major public scandal or a major public snafu, heads would roll, not literally, but metaphorically. Somebody would lose a job. People would, you know, essentially pay a political price. What Trump has done, and, you know, I do think this is a sort of fairly unique characteristic of the Trump era, is he has completely gotten rid of the notion of collective responsibility at a government level. And he's completely gotten rid of the notion of shame at a government level. So you now have, in one position after another in the Trump administration, the most shameless, feckless people. People who have no sense of decency, no sense of right and wrong, and no sense that if they're caught doing something either really, really bad, like in the Epstein files, or really, really stupid, like arbitrarily closing the airspace around El Paso for 10 days and then canceling that closure because the military and the civilian systems didn't coordinate on the testing of a new drone. In the old days, the defense secretary would have gone for that. In the old days, the Homeland Security Secretary would have gone for that. But today, bupkis, nobody pays a political price anymore for either ineptitude or criminality. And I think all of that sort of gets synthesized and summarized in the Epstein files, because what you're basically saying is there's a group of people at the top who have no sense of responsibility and no sense of shame. And once you have a governing class with no sense of shame, that's when really, really bad things happen. That's when it becomes completely acceptable to feed at the trough. That's when cronyism and corruption becomes completely institutionalized, all of which we're seeing at the moment with the Trump administration.
I brought up Noam Chomsky, and I just wanted to quickly hear your reflections, just because I think a lot of progressives and those on the left are in some ways just crushed by his inclusion. And if you read his emails to Epstein, it's, you think of this, you know, this fighter, this icon of the left, anti-establishment, and then seeing those emails, it was really, it was just crushing to a lot. So I don't, a couple, just some reflections on Chomsky. What the heck, what was going on with Chomsky? I mean, this isn't a psychological analysis program, but I'm wondering if you share with a lot of people on the left this sort of, it was a kick in the gut.
I mean, I do and I don't. I understand why people are infuriated by it. I'm far more infuriated by the people in the Epstein files who were clearly involved in sexual encounters with underage girls. I mean, that to me is the real scandal at the core of the Epstein files. The fact that a 90-year-old Noam Chomsky is having, you know, some email exchange with Epstein, it doesn't bother me nearly so much. And I would say the same, you know, had it been a 90-year-old on the right of the political spectrum, I'd say the same thing. You know, to me, the people who are really culpable here are the ones who were using Epstein as part of a sex trafficking network. And I, you know, unless I'm missing something, I'm not seeing that in the correspondence between Chomsky and Epstein. So, you know, to me, that's a sort of fairly marginal side story on a much bigger, more sordid scandal.
John, what are your thoughts on Chomsky?
Well, I of course agree with Sasha that it's completely insignificant and trivial compared to the larger questions and the culpability of hundreds, if not thousands of people in the sex trafficking and abuse of women and girls. At the same time, I get where you're coming from, Robert. And, you know, I never lionized Chomsky myself. I recognize his enormous contributions to the left, but he's made some very big mistakes in his lifetime politically, I think around the resistance in Syria and so forth. So, our heroes always have feet of clay, right? And I think that that is a problem on the left. It continues to be. It always has been a problem, the way people overlook weaknesses and moral foibles within our own ranks. So I don't think we need to go overboard and just, and castigate or demonize Chomsky. But at the same time, when he's like expressing sympathy for this convicted pedophile even sympathizing about how the Me Too movement has basically become hysterical and out of control. I mean, I don't think he should be above criticism. So, I think that on the left, that is something. I think that's a legitimate thing to talk about and worry about. Yeah. But again, if we set up our people as, in these heroic ways, then of course they're going to fall all the further. And I don't think that's necessary. I do want to just briefly to talk about this post-shame environment that we're in. And I totally agree, of course, that Trump has given license to these kind of atavistic, libidinal forces in a way that it was quite shocking and new. But I just want to say that the erosion of a kind of common bourgeois sensibility around decency and so forth had been going on for a very long time in civil society, with the vulgarization of the mass media, reality television, the WWE, Vince McMahon and his wife, who ran this really a fascist aesthetic sensibility through the WWE. All of that was cultural preparation. Gun culture, hunting culture, again, like the violence, this didn't come out of just out of the blue, this vulgarization. We see it. I mentioned this, I think, on an earlier broadcast. The Khashoggi murder by Bin Salman, and the fact that the PGA is now quite happy to cozy up with him. This kind of cultural erosion of common decency runs in parallel with the genocide in Gaza and other international atrocities that are tolerated by and normalized by the international community. So that's what really frightens me, and especially now with AI and the kinds of things, the boundaries get pushed, I guess lower and lower in terms of what people expect, the debasement of the human condition, the celebration of sadism and violence, which is fascism, right, is embedded in all these cultural institutions and trajectories that precede Trump and that are now made permanent by the right-wing propaganda machine and environment, abetted by these techno-billionaires who are providing a means for totalitarian surveillance through AI. And that, by the way, is something we might talk about. That is new. I mean, the East German Stasi and KGB had nothing like the kinds of tools that Larry Ellison and Sam Altman and Elon Musk and others are providing to the national security state. That to me is the future. I mean, it could complete control of the population through surveillance.
Quick break right away. Just have to let people know you're listening to the Peace and Social Justice Program. I'm joined by Sasha Abramsky and John Senbonmatsu. And this program is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your state local partner with the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts has been creating economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and publishing bi-monthly arts and culture newsletters. To stay in the know or have your event listed, visit friendsof.art. Also, Peace and Justice is made possible by Lost on Main at 319 Main Street in Chico, presenting a fundraising show for Safe Space on Saturday, February 21st. The bands include Americana Folk from Lish Bills, Kumbaya Surf from Los Clown Bloods, and Garage Rock from Diamond Snatch. Factory 21 and older with valid ID, please. Ticket and details at the Lost on Main website. Well, so thanks for tuning in here to the Peace and Social Justice Program. John, I had pulled up a little quote. We've talked about the Gramsci quote before, and I just wanted to bring it up, and I want to hear what Sasha has to say too about this surveillance state that we're in, and this all connects. You know, Gramsci wrote in his prison notebooks, which I believe was in the 1930s, quote, "If the ruling class has lost consensus, that is, if it no longer leads but only rules, it possesses sheer coercive power. This actually means that the great masses have become detached from traditional ideologies. They no longer believe what they previously used to believe. The crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. In this interregnum, morbid phenomena of the most varied kind come to pass." Or as I think Zizek said, you know, it's time, the time of monsters. But anyway, John and Sasha, are we in the interregnum now, between the time between when there's a shakeup, and it disconnects what you were saying, is that the masses have become detached from their traditional ideologies. John, you mentioned the sort of sadism. I think about the loss of values, and I think about sometimes it seems like the Trump cult is like a death cult, right? They think about our Health and Human Services, measles outbreaks, this anti-flourishing health proposals. We have the EPA recently, the Obama endangerment got overturned or got pulled. We have these concentration camps, the quote, detainment camps. There is a certain pleasure, you know, this sadistic pleasure in owning the libs. It isn't upending of traditional ideologies. So I don't know, John and Sasha, what do you, are we in, is Gramsci right? Are we in this moment of the interregnum where these diseases, they manifest?
Well, since I spoke somewhat at length last time, I'll keep my answer brief because I'd like to hear Sasha's analysis of this. It's a death cult. It's the antisocial state, as I think of it. The fact that they're waging war on the fundamental basis of human public health and safety and so on. I mean, it's a deepening of the neoliberal project of and austerity and so forth, but really twisted and irrational turn. I agree. I think of J.K. Rowling's The Death Eaters in the Harry Potter series. So, yeah, I think it's right that what's most disturbing is that this is resonating with a very significant portion of the American population, 30-40%. It keeps, you know, changing. And that this resonance is a confluence between sectors of the ruling elite, right, and a population that, as you say, has become really disengaged, disassociated from the traditional sources of moral and political authority that have long stabilized the system. I remember when Bernie and Trump were first running in the two presidential elections ago, no one thought that they had a chance. And then Bernie began winning caucuses and primaries, and the Democratic Party went into a panic mode. And the GOP thought it could control Trump. No one thought Trump could win. And he swallowed the GOP whole. So that shows that, you know, the ruling class does not rule in a certain sense. And yet, obviously, they, in terms of class interests, they still rule. Anyway, maybe Sasha in his response might get back to the question you had raised about the different ways in which these scandals around Epstein being taken up in the UK. Maybe the UK still has these shreds of moral decency. I don't know. I don't want to be too optimistic about it.
Yeah, Sasha, what do you think?
Well, I mean, just answering what you were saying, John, about England, you know, as I said, there still is more of a governing standard around responsibility and shame at the leadership level than there is in the US. That's been abundantly clear for years now. But in terms of, you know, whether we're in this sort of interregnum moment that Gramsci identified, there was another writer in the 20s, I think, called José Ortega y Gasset, and he wrote this book called The Revolt of the Masses. And one of the things he was sort of talking about was a mass political culture that was largely detached of a sense of obligation. So you would demand and expect certain economic benefits of modern life, and you demand and expect certain creature comforts, but you had no sense that that came with a political obligation to, you know, what, maybe get involved politically and maybe think through the implications of political choices. And when Ortega y Gasset was writing about the revolt of the masses, he was talking about the rise of a mass political culture that was fundamentally disengaged from the great questions. and was really only concerned with bread and circuses, which was the sort of Roman way of keeping the masses pacified. And I think, you know, to a large extent, we're seeing that today. You know, John, you mentioned the whole idea of these, you know, world wrestling things and ultimate fight championships and all this sort of iconography that glorifies a particularly overt form of violence. And I think we're seeing it today with ICE recruitment strategies. New York Times actually had a great article on it today that the Trump administration's strategy is very explicitly to go after young men who are preoccupied with violent video gaming and to treat things like ICE enforcement as essentially an extension of violent video gaming fantasy land. And so if you've got an awful lot of people who are being recruited into a national security state with the lure that they can essentially enact violent video game fantasies and have impunity or immunity, as J.D. Vance said of the shooters in Minneapolis, they have absolute immunity. You're setting the stage for a catastrophe, because not only are you creating this high-tech national security state reliant on AI and all of the tools that AI generates, but you're creating a mass cultural mindset that has no room for empathy, and that quite the reverse, glorifies cruelty, humiliation, and violence. And that is quintessentially a fascist mindset. I mean, that was, you know, at its core, what fascism was about was the iron boot or the iron fist. It was about an assault on the flesh. And we're seeing that very viscerally on the ground, not just in Minneapolis, but all over the country, with these young men who've been given an extraordinary amount of weaponry and government uniforms and masks so they can do all of it in secret and are being told they can go after their enemies, whoever so defined. Well, as I said, that's a recipe for a complete breakdown, not just of the institutions of democratic government, but of the culture that underpins democracy.
John, I wanted to pick up on something. We have just a few minutes left, and you had mentioned the surveillance state, and you said this is unique. This is unique to our moment. And I was there is a quote from, I wanted to just read just a quick quote from a book from 1985, Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death, in which he's in the foreword, he's comparing the novel 1984 with Brave New World. Let me read you a quick quote. I want to get both of your feedback on this. He says, Huxley and Orwell did not prophesy the same thing. Orwell warns that we will be overcome by an extremely imposed oppression. But in Huxley's vision, people will come to love their oppression, to adore the technologies that undo their capacities to think. What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban a book. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us. I think he's very prescient there in 1985. Peter Thiel, Palantir, the surveillance state, all this information being used, it all connects to Trump's plans to subvert the elections. I want to end on this question of AI and surveillance and how, it, as you said, John, how it connects to fascism, if you and Sasha can respond to that.
Well, I just want to thank you. I've always thought I had to choose between Huxley and Orwell, and now I see it's possible that we can have our dystopian futures together. Yeah, that's an interesting quote. Yeah, but I think both are true, both perspectives. Yeah, so in terms of maybe we should need a whole show on the techno-fascist turn, but it's really terrifying. The amount of money that's being put into these systems of AI is frightening. Something like 70%, meanwhile, of young people have turned to AI for companionship. What we see in terms of the deepening of alienation in our culture, the anchorless state of many young people who don't have any sense of historicity, they've lost that. The culture has really separated them from the past. So we all live in an eternal now. And then, of course, the national security state weaponizing this in league with monopoly capital. right? To monetize human behavior and to manipulate human behavior, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's so many different layers to this in the way it's a catastrophe for the planet and for the human condition and human personality. I'll just say that AI is the natural complement to a new form of fascism that could be at least as lethal as the first wave fascism, but last much longer, you know, than we saw in the classical fascist period.
Sasha, what connections do you see between the rise of AI and surveillance capitalism and fascism, the techno-fascist state?
I mean, one of the most horrifying things for me is the complete implosion of the assumption of privacy. So you have young people who just assume that every aspect, not just of their external life, but of their interior life, is going to be known to algorithms and is going to be usable and exploitable. And that doesn't worry them. And privacy, you know, for all the flaws of liberal democracy, privacy is a core part of the liberal democratic project, the philosophical project. When you get rid of notions of privacy, you open the door to an all-powerful state and or all-powerful corporations. And almost definitionally, you lower the power of individuals to fight those corporations and that state. You know, AI is relatively speaking in its infancy. There have been sort of primitive versions of it maybe for a decade or two. But the kind of AI we're seeing, ChatGPT, you know, Sam Altman's whole infrastructure of AI, the hundreds of billions of dollars that Google and Meta and Tesla and these other companies are investing in AI is something we've never seen before. And yes, it's going to give us all kinds of baubles, you know, on the surface, it's going to make things fun and blah, blah, blah. Underneath the surface, it's going to have devastating effects for jobs. It's going to have devastating effects for human creativity. And quite possibly, it's going to enact Aldous Huxley's nightmare of a passive population where everything is spoon-fed to us. Because, you know, fundamentally, one of the things that makes us human is our ability to challenge and our ability to say no to things. And one of the other things that makes us human is our ability to get things wrong. Machines get things right all the time. They're digital. We're sort of analog creations. We, you know, think of us like an LP record where we have a little bit of scratch and a little bit of warp on the sound. That's what makes us interesting. And AI gets rid of all of those rough edges. And it just says, all right, we're going to give you a set of indisputable answers. Well, yeah, maybe we'll have machines giving us indisputable answers, but it's going to do something fundamentally corrosive to the human soul. And I do believe that. I do believe that Palantir and all these other groups that are charging ahead with these vast databases that are going to underpin the AI world, I do believe that they are trading profits for a huge amount of what it is to be human. And I think that over the generations to come, that's a Faustian bargain. I do not like the direction that AI is taking our culture.
Well, as someone who teaches critical thinking to young 18, 19-year-olds, I go back often to Gramsci, who believed that critical thinking is, you know, liberation starts with critical thinking, and Paulo Freire, who believed that education is a project of freedom, right? And these notions are, I despair when I go into my critical thinking classes. And I want to end with this. John Sanbonmatsu, you sent a photograph today, I believe. You emailed me a photograph that you took at Logan Airport. It's an ad for an AI company in Palo Alto called Turing. And here's what you say. Here's what this is a billboard in the airport. It said, "Turing, we teach AGI to think, reason, and code so you don't have to." I think that's kind of, sadly, that says it all. That's what we aspire, to neither think, reason, nor code. We turn it over to Turing and these other AI. Thank you both for taking the time to be on the show, and thank you so much for sharing your insights.
Thanks for having us, and always a pleasure, Robert and Sasha. Thank you both.
Yes, thank you. Much enjoyed it. We'll be right back.
you are tuned to listener support.